You are listening to the Birth Bruja podcast, radical, transformative, empowering birth work in all its nuances. Reproductive justice, racial justice, reclaiming ancestral wisdom, decolonizing the birth space. Here, my friends, we go deep. Join us each month as we chat with activists, scholars, healers, community wellness workers, birthing folk, and beyond to explore topics from their roots to their leaves. You are listening to episode 12, Money and Privilege of the Heart on Sleeve series. We are joined by birth workers Daniela Morales, Kelia Elder, and Brooke Patmore. This is part two of a two-part series where we dive into conversations that are typically reserved for behind closed doors. In this episode, we continue exposing our proverbial underbelly by diving into the conversation of money, privilege, and birth work. I am particularly grateful for my guests being open to record such a conversation because A, this is an extremely charged topic that can easily isolate and trigger those present and listening, and B, each of us in the room carry very different intersections of privilege and marginalization. Thus, I find it interesting how, despite all of our differences in identity and life situation, there are so many similar threads. Since this topic could bring out the awkward chicken in all of us, I decided to start the conversation by sharing a bit about my own intersections of money and privilege in the effort to set the tone. Despite me planning on spilling these beans, I can attest to my heart pounding and chest tightening as I continued to share. It was such a naked feeling, and I was very much aware of how I was opening myself up to folks viewing me differently, critiquing me in brand new ways. Did I say everything I meant to say? Mostly. Did I say it half as eloquently as I meant to? Not even. In just the first few minutes of recording the show, I was reminded of the courage and humility that is required to show up for these challenging conversations again and again. Thus, I dedicate this episode to all of us out there doing this work, doing our best to navigate the complexity of power, privilege, and identity, doing our best to continue to put our intentions into words and actions, seeking courage and humility as we continue to show up. And once again, special thanks to my guests for allowing such exposing conversation to be recorded. As someone who is mixed race, with that experience came growing up with also two very different socioeconomic worlds. My mom's Mexican. I lived with her and I saw my dad twice a week. And living with my mom was very much like Midwest blue collar experience. And we lived in a white community and we were like, you know, with our two little talons hanging on into, you know, being able to stay in that community where a lot of my friends were white with blonde hair and highlights, and their moms were stay-at-home moms with big, shiny, red acrylic nails, and, like, folks got brand-new Mustangs on their 16th birthday because in Michigan, a lot of the big wigs work for the auto industry. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that were not at all my experience. And I also want to acknowledge that we had a home, and we had food on the table and had clothes. You know, I was able to participate in a lot of extracurricular stuff because my parents made it happen. And so there's a lot of privilege there, too. And being in that community, I was very aware about how different our experience was. And meanwhile, my dad is an attorney, and it was while I was in high school that he started to become really successful. So then suddenly we went from, like, you know, $10 seats at the Tigers game eating, like, $1 hot dogs to much more expensive seats at the Tiger baseball games with, like, you know, then
three hot dogs.
Three hot dogs, exactly. And I remember, like, noticing when my dad switched. I forgot the beer he used to drink, but it was like Coors Light or something shitty like that. And then he started drinking Blue Moon. Mm. And I'm like, oh, daddy's got money now. Like, I remember, like, you know, just that shift. And so it went from, like, being in a home where my mom And I also want to acknowledge my mom's going to transcribe this episode. And Mom, I just want to have the caveat that I'm very happy with my childhood. Okay, you did great. But also acknowledging that, like, I never felt like I could – now I'm talking to my mom. I never felt like I was comfortable asking you for things, because even if you said yes, I'd feel guilty because I knew that you were busting your ass. You had another job on top of your full-time job. Mm. She'd be at home transcribing. So she'd be up, like – all hours, oh, just like getting this done to get extra money for us to buy, like, you know, basketball shoes and stuff like that. And so go from that situation to then visiting with my dad, where we went out all the time. And my dad would buy me, you know, randomly go shopping, which is also a huge privilege to randomly go shopping. And he'd buy me like a really nice jacket, and it would be really cool, and I'd really like it because all, you know, kids at school were wearing like Abercrombie and Aeropostale and all that shit. And I'd feel like, oh, I can fit in, but then I'd feel guilt because I know that my mom hadn't bought anything nice for herself, or that my brother, you know, my older brother, his basketball shoes had like big holes in the side. So there is this, what felt like a dichotomy. So then fast forwarding to here and the now, I am a product of both worlds, where I am very aware of my privilege in regards to knowing that because of my dad's hard work and because of my grandparents' hard work, my grandparents saved like squirrels. They were depression babies. They had nothing. Like, hunger was a really big narrative in my grandfather's childhood. And so therefore they saved everything. And then when we got to college, I'm the eldest grandchild on that side. They surprised me with money to help pay for a semester of school. Wow. And so therefore, because of their gift and because I was able to have a dad who helped me pay it off, like, I was able to pay off all my student loans in my 20s, which I know is very, very rare.
I just got chills.
Unheard of. I know, y'all. This is very real here. I'm exposing it all. And it isn't, it's both like, when I say embarrassing, meaning that it's such a huge gift and it's such a straight up privilege. And I know it's not normal. I know, like, painfully, like, I know so many loved ones who are fucking struggling to barely make their payment. And I know it's a huge thing. And so anyways, it's because of that privilege, honestly, that I have been able to do things such as afford to then pay for a doula training, you know, to afford for the transition time when I turned from a doula trainee into doing it professionally, right? Where, like, you need the experience, and to do get the experience, you have to do it unpaid, but then how do you do unpaid when you need money? You know, because I didn't have that big debt, I was able to, like, save a little mound of money and being able to, like, you know, okay, I'm just going to accept any birth that came to me. And I was able to power through. It was 2 months. Mm. And then also talking about privilege and power, my partner, he has a full-time job. He able to support himself. I didn't have to, but I knew that if I wasn't able to handle my part of the rent, there's a good chance that he'd be able to help me cover me. And then, again, to continue this conversation, I'm not sending my parents money. I don't have to take care of anyone else physically or financially. So because of all of these things, I was able to merge into this work in a very different timeline than a lot of folks. So in that, it's really uncomfortable when I want to relate to my comrades. And I want to share experiences, and I want to sustain myself in this work. I want to be able to, especially talking about babies, like, I want to be able to save up enough money to be able to buy basketball shoes for my kiddo. I want to be able to eventually try to afford to move into a home. And I also know how, for so many people, it's inaccessible. Hiring a birth worker is almost like a luxury, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, it's like getting a massage. It's a luxury. It's like, no, bro, like, this is... everyone deserves a doula. I'm going to pull that from the roots of labor. Everyone deserves to have someone in the room that has experience, that has you in mind and to hold. And so therefore, I want to make myself accessible. And then on the flip side, there's a lot of folks with privilege out here. Mm-hmm. So there's this whole other dynamic of my work where there's folks who live in ginormous houses, who have lifestyles that are totally different than mine, that I realize that the cost of hiring me, of hiring the team, is just a drop in the bucket to them. And then this, that weirdness, at least for me, it feels weird. It's like, wow, I'm like really stressed out about making sure that I cook enough food so that I don't have to spend money at the next birth,
because hospital food's so expensive. Like, it's like, it's weird to like been like, I'm freaking out about this, and mm-hmm. then you just offered me really expensive sparkling water with cheese. Like, thank you for doing that. And this is so weird. So to put all my shit out there, the navigation of money and privilege is a really juicy topic because it's hella uncomfortable, because it triggers so many people. And it's something that's, I think, really important to dive into because it brings up conversations around integrity, ethics, compassion, the redistribution of resources, self-worth, all those things. All your faces are still looking at me, blinking, blinking. But no, I just...
It's everything you're saying is so spot on that my brain is like firing. There's so many things to think about with this.
What is your journey into around money and privilege? What has that been like for you, Kelia, in birthwork?
Similar looks at both sides of the coin. My family was originally surviving on a pastor's salary. One parent was providing with five kids. And then we moved to East Africa, so I grew up in both places. And one of the reasons my parents moved us there was so that we would be exposed to just how privileged we still were. So instantly, as soon as we moved to Uganda, we were in the top, you know, the top tier when it came to class. I mean, we could hire people. There was somebody who cooked our meals. There was somebody who cleaned our clothes. There was somebody who took care of our dogs. There was someone who cleaned the garden. Like, just from that difference, and my parents were very, you have to see, this is what extreme poverty looks like. And we're going to like do what we can to remember our privilege and like help in a way that isn't like shitty, like no savior complexes around. But like, I've seen both sides of it. And to be honest, the conversation around class in the U.S. often makes me really uncomfortable for the additional reason of like our quality of life here. Even if we're in student debt, we're still in the top tier globally. Like, the ways that we think are so beyond what families think. Like, the average salary in Uganda is $2 a day. And they have kids. And, you know, they have, like, they're trying to send their kids to school. Like, so I think that is really important to hold. And, oh, my gosh, when it comes to, like, making it as a doula, everything you're saying, like, when you're walking into a family's house that is so clearly... they're so clearly wealthy, and you're like, oh gosh, I explained my sliding scale to them over the phone. Like, why was they wasting their time? And they're like, no, it's okay. I can afford your full fee.
I'd just like to interject and say, in my experience, I found some of the wealthiest ones are the ones trying to get the deal.
Yes, they are.
Like, I'll offer them the sliding scale, they'll take it. And then I get there and I'm like,
That's a new Tesla. One time I got, they had bought a second Tesla.
What the fuck?
Like, I know. Listen. Or this one woman, she was like, hey, so I hear you offer a sliding scale. We'd really like to take advantage of that because with the full-time nanny we've hired, and I only get 3 months of paid leave. So, like, how do you have that conversation? So actually what I've started doing just in the last few months is saying, I have a sliding scale. If you're interested, let me know. And then I send them something that breaks down into different tiers. So I say, like, if you're in this category, some examples that might put you in this category are you don't have debt. Or if you do have debt, it doesn't stop you from meeting your basic needs. So you can pay for transport, rent, and food without worrying. Maybe you own a car or you rent a car or you are able to go on a vacation once a year without financial hardship. If that's you, then I'm expecting you to pay the full fee. And then I break it down with, you know, middle class and then lower class. And so it's like a quick class lesson for them. If they think that, like, yeah, just because they bought the new jet, then they can't afford their doula, then, like, it's kind of like, that's not how I'm thinking. And so far it seems to work. They're like, oh, yeah. I could tell they were looking for a deal. And then once they saw, like, oh, I guess people are poorer than me, they reel it in.
Yeah. Especially out here. And especially within more political spaces, people don't want to acknowledge their privilege because it's like so mainstream, you know? It's like, oh man, yeah, like I struggle. And then they go to like Rainbow Grocery and spend $600.
Or like, I grew up poor, so I deserve to not like, I don't know.
Critique,
it's also hard
though,
because then I also have friends who like, are financially struggling, but they like they deserve to have like the luxuries that everyone else does too, you know? Like, I'm trying hard when I'm going to these families' homes, I'm trying not to like police their financial use. Like, like it's okay that you ordered pizza instead of rice and beans. Maybe it's not, quote unquote, the most fiscally responsible thing, but you don't deserve to be punished over and over for being a poor person.
That's true. That's
it's
true.
Not your fault. And
thank you for saying that, because also I know my total judgmental, gross, mean person that's like deep inside that sometimes like judges.
Me too. Me too.
Like, that's a very helpful thing to remember. And also too, about privilege, is that there's a lot of unseen things, right? So you could see someone who makes a shit ton of money in the peninsula and they may be shipping a third of their income to their family overseas. Yeah. Or also in the context of my partner, a lot of people perceive that he's an able-bodied person, but he's suffered from chronic pain for most of his adult life, and he's still paying off medical bills from surgery that happened years ago. Oh. So that's also something, right, that like we wouldn't see on the surface. And that plays into understanding of, you know, we can have understandings around gender and race and all these things. And yes, that analysis can be there, and that compassion of showing up and knowing that critique is still there, and like these are individuals that we're dealing with, just as we are individuals. So let's like bring it back to you. Can you just speak more, I guess, if you don't mind, to how you've been navigating
as a doula specifically,
and being in the Bay, because you've only been here for a few months now, right?
Oh my gosh, the hustle is so real. I mean, you just, birth workers especially, because we're already giving people, and because the schedule is crazy. The other week I left home on Tuesday, I got home on Sunday after 3 back-to-back births. I needed the money, you know, like I had backup people just in case, but I was like, I got 2.5 while she was on her epidural, like I can do it. And thankfully I was tapping and making sure I wasn't like losing my mind, and I think I provided good care, but I didn't want to have to compensate someone else just because I like needed rent. And I'm like supporting myself and my partner right now, and so that hustle is so real, working your tail off. When I first got into this, I had a similar privilege that you were talking about, Ari, where I had a partner who made enough to support us both so I could have those few months to ramp up your business. I've heard several doulas like share with newer doulas saying like, just go for it. Like, stop hesitating and just like grab it and do the thing, like commit, and then the clients will come. And I know they're speaking from a place of privilege where maybe if they didn't have the money, there was someone out there where like if they were about to get evicted, they could call on that person. Mm-hmm. And some people just don't have that. Or like, it means you're going without health insurance.
Right.
There's so many things that a person saying that is not thinking of. And it really gets me. But I didn't have that. I had somebody who was providing for me so I could slowly ramp everything up and then eventually start charging enough to like stay afloat. I feel like this topic is controversial and talked about in birth circles everywhere because it's like, well, how much do you charge? And like, well, I'm more experienced than you, so you shouldn't be charging that much. Like, we're all trying to tell each other what to do, and it gets really dirty really fast.
That's true. Brooke, how did your transition into birth work, how did that journey go for you in terms of navigating the hustle of it as well? Because I know you are very community attuned and you are really wanting to show up with integrity. So how did you navigate what you needed versus accessibility to others and so forth?
To be honest, I'm still figuring it out. I think it was really hard. I mean, I do want to acknowledge that I have an immense amount of privilege just in the fact that I'm white and coming from a middle-class family. I grew up in the Bay Area, like in California, in America, the U.S. So there's so much I hold in that. But, you know, when I got into birth work, I am single. I don't have a partner. I also don't have any dependents. I don't have any kids to take care of or any other family members to take care of. But I got into birth work after moving back from living overseas for a good amount of time, living off of, you know, nonprofit money, like very little money. And I never had culture shock when I moved overseas, but moving back into the Bay, moving back into San Francisco, I had total reverse culture shock and also just felt so overwhelmed at like, how the fuck am I going to make it here? I mean, I was obsessively applying for jobs that I would never want to do and like trying to just hustle here and there. I even like ran food for Postmates, did all sorts of things. But getting started, yeah, I couldn't. I had to like hold another job and then figure out how to start, you know, doing the volunteer shifts. And also I think what's something that's challenging for me is I do feel like everybody deserves a doula. And if I could, like this work that, and I think it's true for all of us, like we come to this work out of our passion. I wish I didn't need to get paid. I would happily do this work for free. But at the end of the day, like, I do need to pay the bills and survive. So a lot of that looks like similar to Kelia. Before I joined the team I work with now, I was a solo doula and then I partnered and I'd be at like births for 3 days straight and I could call my partner in or a backup, but I'm like, I'm not giving money over. Right. Like I can't, you know. So I did a similar thing. I started offering a sliding scale and I quickly learned that I needed to offer a little diagram of where you might fall in this sliding scale. I volunteer, but I also balance that with charging a higher fee and for folks that can pay for it. But it's a constant thing that I'm trying to navigate. And as a white person, I feel pretty strongly that I should be paying back reparations to folks of color. Mm. And so I try to take a percentage of what I make and give it to organizations that are, you know, training up doulas of color and allowing doulas to be accessible for folks in their own community, because I don't think I'm the right person necessarily to serve those communities, but I should put my money where my mouth is. You know? So it's a really hard thing to kind of navigate and figure out. I don't have a health insurance in the Bay. In order to qualify for Medi-Cal, like impossible to live on what, like, I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out. I don't know how I can afford to pay $400 to $500 a month to cover my, and that's something in this work, you know, we're creating our own businesses. So we don't have, like, I don't get sick time. I don't have, like, what happened. And that's something I've actually had to be thinking about a lot. Like, what am I going to be doing, like, if I get hurt? Like, this job is so physical. And what do I do if I can't, like, at this point, I'm just like, I'm fucked if like
if you can't work.
How do I hold my core values and hold to my truth, but also like get paid what's fair and equitable for me to live and survive? You know, it's a balance. Still working it out.
Yeah, hear you.
Without letting the concern for money like mentality take over. Even the interaction I have with my client, you know, like I want it to be community based and like have this relationship that is not just like this exchange of goods. Yeah. I know some doulas who talk that way and I hear that, like we are here to provide a service and it is valuable when care service often isn't valued very highly. But I don't know, like when the money side of it creeps in too much, then you can feel a shift in how much, how that person trusts
you. Listen, money carries energy. Mm-hmm. It has intense energy. We all have our own shit around it, right? Yeah. Like going back to the last episode of We Aren't Enough, like I often feel like I'm not responsible enough or not wise enough or whatever, like with the funds that I receive. And navigating those with other people asking for money and then things happen and some people want a discount here or discount there. Like, what if this happens? I'm having to be like, no, like you still gotta pay me. Like my time is valuable, right? Like I don't think a lot of folks understand what it means to live a life on call. And that is a big chunk of a fee that we're asking. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, at any point in time, we're ready to put our life down and come to you. That means that I don't get to leave. I don't get to leave the city. Mm-hmm. I don't get to partake in
adult beverages.
Or other fun activities. You know, like I have to live kind of a whole different lifestyle.
Yeah. And also saying no to other work to make sure that you have enough. I have another question for y'all. And Danielle, if you wanted to speak to this, just because you haven't Jipped in.
We keep taking up all this.
I know. Yes.
No, no, it's fine.
Is that in the topic of thinking about price, right? Have y'all ever run into issues of like, well, I'm not really that good? Or like, well, you know, like, again, Googling on the internet and being like, oh, that like epic, amazing midwife charges this. And wow, she's been doing this for 25 years. And, you know, like, have you run into that?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, so I've taken on, so I work with the team, right? And we have an on-call schedule, and the price is set by the owner of the company, and it's amazing how it operates. So I've taken on clients on my own, and with the personal client, I had to put, you know, this limit down of how much I needed, and I gave her my price point, and I did. I had to, like, really do that personal work of like, wait, how much am I worth? Mm. Right? Did the research, looked around, and ultimately it came down to, no, fuck that. I am worth this much. And to be honest, I don't think I had any guilt like setting my price. And my price is pretty high. Like, I'm not gonna lie, like, my price is pretty high. But I came at it like, I got a kid, I got my family, I have my own shit that I have to pay for. Like, if I'm going to do this work outside of my own on-call schedule, then it needs to be worth it. I need to know that I'm getting paid for my time, my energy, my love, my space. And so, so no, I didn't feel guilty.
Yes.
And, like, I know, like, I offer amazing work. Like, I'm an amazing doula, and I've done the self-care. I've done all the classes. I've done everything that I need to do to get myself to this point where I can say that. So, yeah.
That's so powerful. Yeah. I mean, and I can't help but think about how different this would be if we were all white men.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, I mean, we'd be like, no, I'm better.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, I'm married to a white man, and baby, I love you. And I know you're used to this. But yeah, just thinking about the culture too, right? Like, as women, as a woman who's been socialized as a woman, who's been socialized as a woman of color, and also within Catholic context, to be a true woman, you have to, like, self-deprecation, right? It's like, oh, no, like, the martyrdom. Yes. And even though birth work, I'm doing air quotes here, it's often prescribed as women's work, right? Which means as if it's something that should just be natural and assumed, and something that, something that's, oh, really awesome in the moment, but that's not like what society is built upon. Right. You know, yeah, it's like extracurricular. There's this like weird culture where it's like, if you're truly passionate about this work, then you're not going to get caught up about money. And then I really love what you said, Brooke, about how money is an exchange of energy. And especially in this context, like, being vulnerable to illness, being vulnerable to losing housing at any moment, like, being vulnerable to losing your car, right? Like, was it a few months ago, I got a $125 ticket while outside at a prenatal in the city because I, like, didn't park in the right time and our visit went over and blah, blah, blah. And that's like more than I freaking make. Like, you know, like, there's so much vulnerability that, that, yeah, it's hard to navigate. You know, it'd be like, yeah, like, I am going to do it for the cause, and I do want to take, you know, low income and free births and all those things. And yeah, it's like to sit in our power and being like, I do want to support you, and this month I can't.
Yeah.
Or like, it, you know, I do want to support you, and like, I'm worth.
Yeah.
Put out there, right? Like, in the Bay, it's very common, right? Like, $2,000. I am worth $2,000.
Yeah.
And if, and it's totally understandable if you can't afford this, you know, totally legit. And here's a list of really quality, you know, folks that I know offer some lower fees.
Yeah.
You know, or there's just ways to do it where we stand in our power while also acknowledging the reality of the various intersections of privilege.
Something that I want to point out is that we don't get paid like the first of the month, the 15th of the month.
Right.
Like, we get paid this flat rate for one family, and that rate has to last us for
who knows
till you get the next client. So yes, like $2,000 sounds like a lot of money to pay for a birth, but that $2,000 might have to last this doula for 3 months. Like real talk.
And
like,
that's not even 1 month's rent in a lot of places.
Exactly. So yeah, like there's different perspectives to have, right?
I think there's a lot of balance that you have to think about when finding what's right for your own self and what you're charging. And one is definitely like, am I going to walk away from serving these people and feel resentful?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So if you are, then raise your price.
Yeah, that's true.
And also like, but then, you know, how much can I take on, like, at lower fee or volunteer in a month to balance? Like, okay, yes, that's really important to my ethic to make room for that. But I need this much of paying clients in order to support that, and how, you know, building that into the practice. Right now I'm actually working on building a practice with two other doulas. And we're, like, thinking about this. And one thing that we want to do is offer a sliding scale, and we use the income index for the city that we're serving in. And it's like, okay, if you make this much, then you can pay this much, you know, and just like make it really simple. And, you know, I think it kind of washes out in the end who can afford what. But I do, you know, like, yeah, there's room to be flexible. But if you're doing the work and you're like, I just was at this birth for 3 days, and they were like, I had emotionally be present for them for like in an intense way for months leading up to it. And I got paid $500, and I don't know if you're walking away feeling really run down, then, you know, maybe you need to raise your price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm also just thinking of birth workers I've heard who like amp each other up being like, yes, we are worth this much and I'm agreeing with everything. And then I'll hear the like, and if they can't afford that much, like they should find a way. They should just like, oh, you've never heard this? I've heard this so many times. Mm. They should just like reprioritize their life, and they will nine times out of 10. I'm like, you're speaking from such ignorance and such privilege that like these families are often, they're like, I wish I could pay you more.
Absolutely.
I wish. And so, oh my gosh, one family, they could only pay me like $200. And then I visited their home. Like I knew that was a stretch for them.
Yeah.
And afterwards, after the birth, they were still like, we wanted to say thank you. Here's $50 more. Aww. And it was like the most giving thing.
Right. Yeah.
And here are people being like, they should just find $3,000 to throw at me. And,
I think it's so interesting that often it is the folks that are struggling the most that are the most generous. Yeah. I find that really, really wild. Another thing I wanted to mention that I've heard a lot is like for people talking to newer doulas getting into the work is just like, just charge this much. Your work. And I get that. But also I found it really helpful for me to be volunteer when I was starting out, and even to charge a lower fee because I knew I didn't feel confident in what I had to offer. And then that made me feel really good about being really honest of like, I don't know the answer to that question yet, I will find out for you. You know what I mean? It helped me actually feel okay when I was going into these spaces and places, like, because there's a lot of pressure when you're first getting into it and you're like, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And like, I don't want to fuck up, but like that kind of takes it away. So that's something to think about as well. I mean, obviously you have to pay the bills and put it on the plate, and some folks who don't have partners can float them or another job. Like you may have to just out the gate start charging, and that's cool. But, you know, there is that aspect too of like, if I'm at a night client, I know I'm not charging a full fee, but if I like don't know something yet because I didn't have as much experience, then I feel really okay being like, I don't know. Let's find out together.
Right. Yeah. I think you remind me of something that I think is really important to acknowledge, which is the power of community and the power of mentorship, right? Like in the context of this hyper-professionalization of this work, there's this weird expectation, right? That we're supposed to be the expert of everything. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, a lot of folks struggle asking for help or asking for like, you know, can I shadow you?
Yeah.
And then on the other side, there's folks that are like, yeah, you can shadow me for $200. Mm-hmm. You know, like,
or 800.
Yeah. I mean, again, I understand too, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of work.
Value of resources and time. And I mean, it's so much more. This is why I appreciated actually working on this team, is because the way that this is built, right? Like, we don't have to deal with that money conversation. Mm-hmm. We don't have to deal with the people who are like suddenly not answering their phones and haven't, you know, paid the second half of their deposit. And so I was able to do the work. And then also I was able to witness how y'all handled your prenatal visits, how y'all mm-hmm. handled, you know, the full range of personalities and clients. Like, I was able to deepen myself in the work before putting my energy then into the conversations around, you know, around money. Yeah. And then also, too, again, there's a lot of pros and cons to this team approach, to our team approach. And one of them is that for better or for worse, there's space slash a need to have either a partner who can help you float, or in my case, I have another job, or, you know, or Brooke, like, I don't know how y'all do it, and Daniela, you too, how you do birth and postpartum, and, mm-hmm. and you, Kelia, like, y'all are superhuman. And so there's some beauty, I think, to being able to hold on to, you know, being able to have a full-time family life, if that's how you want to prioritize. Mm-hmm. To be able to, in my case, to be able to continue my work with the Rape Crisis Center, and that's flexible enough that my boss, you know, if I'm like, sorry, baby, she'll be like, okay, good luck, see you tomorrow or in 2 days. Like, there's some beauty in that. But also, yeah, mm-hmm. there's also a struggle in being in the in-between. What I appreciate about the way that y'all have been answering this conversation is just showing how it's constantly a work in progress. Mm-hmm. And on the and in the realm of ethics and integrity and philosophy, I also, and then knowing you individually and also how you presented yourself here, I think sometimes it's really easy to approach these conversations like it's a flowchart, yeah, as if there's like a one-size-fits-all sort of thing. And maybe that's helpful to some people, but I, in my opinion, to truly be of service, to truly continue to take care of ourselves, and to truly come into this work with integrity, we constantly have to be reevaluating.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Again and again and again. Mm-hmm. If we're hanging out with folks that are similar background and similar access, again, to privilege in the moment, I mean, that's cool and comfortable, but also, like, check yourself, mm-hmm. yeah. right? And maybe it's time to get out of your box.
Yeah.
I want to shift this to our next final section of questions, which is questions from the community. This is kind of rapid style, okay?
All right.
Mm-hmm. So prepare thyself.
It's like a couple sentences each.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. What do you do when you need the money, but you don't vibe with the birthing couple?
Exactly to what you just said, there's no black and white. The whole thing is gray. Like, if I need the money, I can suck it up and be a really loving person around them, and I'll do it. If it's not, like, a threat to my safety and health.
Yeah.
Huge threat.
I feel like with the team that we work in, we don't have, like, a big say-so in the clients that we take. I mean, because we work in a team, we're able to take 9 clients a month, right? Like, mm-hmm. which is amazing because we see a variety of things. But do we vibe with all of them? Nah, not all the time. But I think it's really helpful having the community, having other members of the team just kind of be like, hey, look, like, I know this is not your people right now, but I can be that space for you when you get out of that crazy-ass prenatal visit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also something really humbling, I think, about being with someone who, you know, where it's like, you know, where you say your normal joke, or like you say your normal jam and you're used to people being like, ha ha ha, or like, or being like, oh, thank you for saying that. And this person just silence.
Yeah.
She's like, not funny.
Yeah. Exactly. I think it's, I feel like it kind of helps to, again, take me back a few pegs and mm-hmm. also be like, and like, what's the bones? Like, what are the bones of this work? Like, how can I truly continue to show up with integrity with someone that, like, we wouldn't hang out if I wasn't here with you for 14, 15, 20 hours.
Well, it helps, like, it helps you define yourself, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it helps you, like, look deeper at yourself and who you are and what you're presenting, and if the things that you are offering are really, like, in tune with you.
Yeah. Yes. And Definitely like gray and like
gray area
for sure, like you were saying, like it kind of case by case basis. But going in back into the worlds of like interviewing, like going out of the model that we're working in, I spent a lot of time taking on clients, you know, before I joined the team I work in now. I learned hard lessons of, you know, like saying yes when there was a lot of red flags from the beginning and being like, oh, I don't know if that was actually worth the stress and the, I don't know, I don't know that it was worth it in the end. And so like, how do we, how do we protect self-care, like take care of ourselves to be, how do we make this work sustaining, right? Because, you know, like we were saying in the team dynamic we I work with now, we don't get the option, but sometimes that's so like intensely draining. But then on the flip side, when you do find folks that you jive with, it's like a whole nother experience and so empowering and life-giving. And not even just like on a selfish level, but like you feel like you can show up in a deeper way for them. And that's, you know, I want to be true to myself in that. So it is something like I've been thinking a lot about. And I think ultimately I just am looking forward to the day that I, you know, I think you eventually get to a place in doula, this kind of career where you get, you are like saying no, you know, like you're getting so many people, you can be choosier essentially. So I guess I look forward to that.
And it takes time, right?
That's again, it's time. Like a true privilege. Like I'm not at that point, and I'm sure there's still a lot of folks that, and I'm grateful for the work I've done in the team we work with now, to like you guys were saying, like it does force you to kind of dig deep on a different level and figure out how you can show up for someone you wouldn't necessarily like pick to be with. But also, there's a heavy balance in it, because it's like, man, if I just like go around like feeling so drained and so depleted, then like I'm not going to be able to do this a long time. Like it, you have to.
Burnout rate is so high for this work.
So on that note about the being in the struggle in the moment and thinking about like, how do I continue? The next question, how do you navigate the oppressive dynamics of the medical industrial complex without allowing your soul to shrivel?
Who wrote that? That's so good.
Okay. So even I want to say this, that even if like a person has an unmedicated birth in the hospital, there are still like ways that their birth is being altered, being changed, being induced, that it wouldn't be, would it, if it is a home birth or like free birth or whatnot, right? So I feel like people sometimes say like, oh, well, you know, I'm having an unmedicated birth with a doula. That doesn't mean that it's going to be all fucking peaches and roses.
We read that the doula lowers the statistical rate of me getting a cesarean. So you're going to help me not get a cesarean, right?
Okay, pressure's on. So we go into the hospitals like having to fight the medical staff in some ways, right? And like usually it's great, like our relationship with them, but sometimes like you really have to fucking navigate like the patriarch. You really have to navigate like privilege in the hospital. And it's hard. It's hard to like save your soul, like you're saying,
and
all of this.
And to just piggyback on a moment here, I think that sometimes when people hear like, oh, sometimes it feels like we're fighting the medical staff, it's actually us not fighting the medical staff. It's it's pushing against the medical culture.
Right.
Where a lot of times the medical staff.
Right. It's not one person. It's
exactly. They're doing what they think is best. They're doing what they've been taught. The majority of folks that I've encountered in the birth room are there because it is a passion of theirs. And it's like the auntie. It's like the auntie who's like coming in telling you how to live your life. And you're like, actually, like that was really fucked up what you just said and problematic for the following ways, but I know you're coming in here doing your best. You know, it's like it's just it's a lot to navigate. Right. And it can be really exhausting in soul shriveling. How have you guys how have you practiced like being able to recognize when oppressive things are happening or violent things are happening? And also like what have you done to take care of yourself and or your client?
I mean, I think most of us can notice pretty quickly whether our client is being treated with disrespect just from the outset. Obviously, if it's a person of color, it's like pretty obvious immediately or however they identify. Like, and I try to get ahead of it as much as I can and sort of like, oh, how, I try to bring them on my side. Like, how long have you been doing this? And, you know, like, do you practice laboring down with your client? You know, like, because I'm not just thinking of my client. That's the priority, obviously. But I'm thinking of all the doulas down the road and all the clients down the road who are going to be working with the same OB or the same shitty nurse and need to have it set up for them. Right. That if I just like chew her out in front of the client, like it's not good for the labor and that she's never going to trust doulas again. So try to like get ahead of it, kind of go out of my way to like suck up to them. Honestly, that's like I'm really, really friendly.
And humanizing.
Yes. And usually, like, if they're just sometimes if it is just like the, you know, 12 end of a 12 hour shift or whatever, and like they like treat my client better. But if it's not, if there is something where I have to put my foot down, like she said, she didn't want you to break her water and you've still got your hand. And like, I know what you're about to, then by the time it comes to that, then like we have more of a rapport where they're going to take me a little more seriously because they know I didn't just come in like with my fists raised. Like I'm ready to fight, but I'm not like looking for it.
Yeah.
Hmm. So a lot of like preventative work.
Yeah.
Which doesn't always work, but
I think it takes a lot of prep work too in talking to the clients like at the prenatal visits like, hey, look, you're going into a system that is trained this way, right? True. Like they want to do cervical checks. They want to have you pushing on your back. Like that's just how they are. So having that prep work done in the prenatal visits to tell them like, hey, when you go in, check into the triage, like ask them if they have a nurse that is familiar with unmedicated birth, right? Because if you don't have a nurse that's familiar with unmedicated birth, guess what? She's going to want to do all the needle sticking and all the cervical checks, right? Like they just don't know better or different. But yeah, prep work ahead of time is really important.
I think it's so, so challenging. I think about this all the time. I know.
For sure.
But it's so hard because it's a system we're fighting, right? It's like we're fighting the patriarchy here.
Right.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's the medical staff, the OB, their training is traumatic. Like how they're trained to do their job and show up what they do is like kind of fucked up. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, there's the whole liability issue. And this extends, honestly, beyond the hospital, even to, like, registered midwives, you know? It's like, and I think people don't realize the responsibility they're taking on by taking you on as a patient, the birthing person. And so they're, at the end of the day, feel this immense pressure, a.k.a. fear, that's driving, that can drive, like, how they're wanting to manage their birth. And so but like Daniela was saying, I think it's really important to have the conversations prenatally about and just around like the education of understanding like, hey, when you're choosing to go birth in a hospital for so many reasons, like that A may be the only option you have. That may be, I don't know, where you feel safest. And that's totally okay. But also understand like you're stepping into your birth being actively managed as opposed to being passively managed. Right. And these are the things you're going to have to navigate. And I want to cut it off where I can. But at the end of the day, like you're going to have to advocate for yourself. Mm-hmm. And like I'm here to help you try to do that. And then, you know, it's I think the other aspect that can be so hard is like I came into this work through the avenue of home birth midwifery and like this really like hands off like, you know, we're letting the birthing person lead us on, the, you know, we're just there as support on the other end. And my first hospital birth as a doula, my client had for her, pretty straightforward second time birth on the epidural. And she had a great experience. Meanwhile, I was standing there like semi-traumatized by like different things I was seeing being done to her because I was like, that's not necessary.
Yeah.
Why are you pulling on the cord right now? Mm-hmm. I had the OB look up to me and look me in the eyes after the baby was delivered and say, isn't natural birth just so overrated?
Wow.
And I was just, this is my first birth in the hospital. And I was good just talk. Like, oh my God. Like, why are you violating her? And I think that's the other aspect that can be so hard is even, like, sometimes our clients actually have good experience, but we walk away carrying this thing of, like, what did I just witness? Right. What did I just see happen? And how do I navigate that? And then I, you know, then the self-talk of, like, what could I have done to, like, save them from this or that? But at the end of the day, it's like, we are – this system is – man, it's
they
something.
They don't see all the things that you're cutting off. Like, they didn't know that you were having that conversation with the nurse out in the hall to say, like, can you please stop referring to her by the wrong – or whatever it is. Like, can you stop doing
it? Or they don't know when you see the OB get the scissors out and start prepping and start putting
– we see it all. We hold so much.
Yeah. It's really intense.
I often – for your question about coping mechanisms, I'm usually texting, like – other doulas being like, this fucked up person just said this fucked up thing. Mm-hmm. And usually just like letting it out that I'm able to like, all right, now how am I going to like deal with this? That's it. Like, just ranting, really.
Yeah. When this question came to be, obviously it's a huge question and it brings up a lot. And one of the things that it reminds me of is how popular birth work conversations can appear very polarizing, right? Where it's like, home birth, free birth, or, you know, as if like free birth is the only true liberational option, or hospital birth is the only responsible option, you know. And what I think is important to realize is that we need everyone. Mm-hmm. Like, we need people who are so firmly believing in free birth and unassisted birthing that they can have the skill set and the articulation and the experience to support people in accessing that deep, deep bravery and trust and surrender. Mm-hmm. And all the while, I think we need the folks who are literally willing to take anyone for a client, who's willing to birth anywhere, knowing that in relation to power and privilege, a lot of folks don't have options financially to birth elsewhere. And also, we live in a place with this built upon systems of oppression. So as you know, we mentioned, I can't remember if it's this episode or last episode, where folks who are socialized as female, for example, are literally raised to put their reproductive well-being in the hands of experts, where we're raised to put our sexuality, our bodies into other people, into our parents, into our partners, right? Like, we don't begin until someone else comes into the picture kind of scenario. So, and that's just the female body, let alone folks, you know, who are queer or trans, who's, you know, who's suddenly their sexuality or their bodies is like a fascinating experiment, right? Like, there's so many dynamics that have been layered into our bones that when we enter the birth room, it can seem, you know, it can seem easy logistically to be like, yeah, and you can decline cervical checks whenever you want because they're not medically necessary. Right. It can seem logistically easy. But then when you're talking to someone who's literally their entire life never been told that they have a right to even have an opinion, let alone, you know, asking them to voice it in the moment and to hold that boundary consistently, you know, for someone who's been told that their skin, that their people, that their cultural practices are just like wives' tales, right? That they're like lesser than. You know, after a lifetime of being told that that white male doctor is truly the person who knows what's best, right, you know, to like suddenly tell them, oh, hey, no, like now's the time to stand up for yourself. It makes sense that there are people who just don't want to. There makes sense that there's people that are just like, I just want to go along with whatever the care providers want to do. And I feel like it's all important. It's important for all of us to hold our peace in this, because it's all needed. Like, we need the people behind the scenes who can tell you, like, actually, the way that your grandmother took care of you when your belly ached, like, that was genius. Like, that was solid. We need someone to go and be like, actually, like, what does pleasure mean to you? And do you want to say yes? Do you want to say no? Do you need more information? You know, like, all those threads come into the birth experience. And as birth workers, a lot of times we're able to see them as they are. We can put these names on there, like racism and homophobia, and like we can articulate it in certain ways. And it's their birth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
We can't define it for them.
Nope.
I know. Yeah. I recently had a client say, I was like, prepping for these kinds of conversations, what to do if somebody suggests something. And she said, literally whatever my husband wants. I can't make those kinds of decisions. Oof. It's entirely up to him. And I was like, like, what do you do with that? She kept saying it. That is what I want, is just whatever he wants.
I had a mama one time who said, I asked her, like, well, what if you do? What if it does end up in induction? Well, you know, I'd rather have the doctors and the medical staff make those decisions, because if something happens, like, I didn't say it. I didn't do it.
Like, I don't want the responsibility, which I get. Like, that's an intense thing. And it's not, like, that's a really good point you bring up, Kelia. It's not always just the hospital.
Yeah.
It's the dynamics and, like, giving. I've been in a birth where I've watched the partner talk the birthing person into getting a cesarean when it was, like, really not necessary, at least in my perspective. And that's like so disheartening. But coming back to what Ari said, it's like I say this like a mantra, not just to myself, but to my all my doula comrades. It is not our birth at the end of the day. And we have to settle on that. And while I probably have a preference to give my resources to folks that are really like ready to, you know, do this a different way. At the end of the day, if that's not the path they're taking, then that's okay too. That's like their own whatever. And we don't know all the things, you know, like there's such, like you're saying, Ari, like when you're coming from like more marginalized identities or different oppressions and like different trauma, like, we just don't know why you have to make. And then there's a whole cultural aspect of how we're like the God complex of doctors. Mm-hmm. Right. And like, or if you're an immigrant in this country and like, you can't talk back to like authority figures or whatever.
Or you might not have the language to say like, I want an epidural or I don't want an epidural.
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As much as I would love to just continue, there's actually more questions here, but we've run out of time. I want to thank y'all so much. I hope that you leave this space feeling good and not, oh shit, why did I say that in public? I know that it took some bravery to agree to have this conversation with me, and I appreciate it. And normally I invite folks to have a more spacious closing, where if any words of wisdom or pieces of advice or just anything that's coming up. But for the sake of time, I just invite you all to take a deep breath with me. And to share one sentence in closing.
Remember who you are.
Find your truth.
And hold self-compassion and kindness very, very close to you.
The music you heard on today's show is Pink by Janelle Monáe. Deep gratitude to Daniela Morales, Kelia Elder, and Brooke Patmore for being our guests. Follow me on Instagram at birthbruja to continue the conversation.
I've been your host, Ari Guajardo Johnson. The Birth Bruja podcast is produced by Catherine Petru of We Rise. Be sure to check out show notes for links and resources. Follow us on SoundCloud and iTunes to help us expand the impact of this work. Until next time, my friends, thank you for all the ways you show up in this world. Blessings and gratitude. Crazy pink as we all go insane.